From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, dark money, outside money, super PAC money pouring into local elections. Who's trying to influence your vote?
You know, the sad thing about a lot of these groups, especially in local races, is that it takes time to figure out who they are.
Lansing's Mayor Virge Bonero stepping down from the job he never thought he wanted.
Because when I read about mayor, you know, it seemed like mayors were always either indicted or died in office or were thrown out of office.
And after 12 years as mayor?
I'll remember it today and always as the best job I ever had.
And John U. Bacon on the great Halifax explosion of 1917.
And in 1/15th of a second, less time than it takes to blink, half of Halifax is gone.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Tomorrow is, of course, Election Day, an off-year election focused on local issues and races. But there's still plenty of money being poured into those local races. Dark money, out-of-state money, super PAC money. Here now to give us a sense of how money influences our local politics and how tough it can be to track that money is Craig Mauger from the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Craig, let's jump straight into looking at some of the races and issues where we're not quite sure where the money's coming from and why, beginning with Flint's mayoral election with 18 candidates running to be mayor of Flint, including incumbent Karen Weaver, all due to a recall stemming from that big fight surrounding Flint's garbage contract. So what is the money story here?
Yeah, well, the money story there is that there are groups that are kind of outside, independent of the candidates, at least on the surface they're independent of the candidates, that are in some ways trying to influence the election there. And, you know, like we're trying to do at the Michigan Campaign Finance Network in all of these races is to try to get our hands around who's behind these groups and what these groups' intentions are. We have obtained some mailers that were sent out there in at least one area of Flint that is from a group that is a complete mystery group. We don't have information on who this group is, but it's a mailer that's going out telling people, you signed a petition to recall Mayor Weaver for signing a garbage contract. That's what her job is, negotiating contracts. And it's this mailer that I think is supposed to be supportive of Mayor Weaver. And it's from a group that we can't identify, at least from this mailer that we received.
Yeah, in fact, you sent me a copy of a mailer opposing candidate Scott Kincaid, saying, among other things, that he, quote, poisoned you with the Flint River water. And it comes from a group called StupidRegisteredVoter.com. Who is that?
Yeah, we're not, in a lot of these cases, we're not sure. You know, the sad thing about a lot of these groups, especially in local races, is that it takes time to figure out who they are. Sometimes documents become available later. We're able to dig out more information, you know, over an extended period of time. These groups often know that and send these types of attacks out late in the election cycle. So it's harder to get this information of who's behind them in many cases in a prompt manner. And we're just not sure on this Flint mailer. Someone sent this mailer to us and said, you know, can you tell me who's behind this? And my answer to them, you know, initially was, no, I can't. You know, I can look into this, but I can't tell you at this point who's behind it.
And over to Lansing with Mayor Virge Bonero not running for re-election. You're finding dark money involved here?
Yeah, that's at least what it appears on the surface. There's a group called Capital City Leadership Project, and we're trying to identify exactly what this group is. It's a group that has at least ordered some airtime, and it looks like ran some ads on at least one Lansing station. They sent out a mailer that was very negative about State Representative Andy Shore, who's one of the candidates there. It criticized him for his involvement in a statewide ballot proposal on road funding, and we're still trying to track down what exactly this group is. Who's behind it? We know from some filings that there's an attorney, a Lansing attorney involved in this, but it's another example of how a group can get involved very late in an election cycle. This group has just started kind of rolling out its mailers and TV ads in the last couple of weeks, just before voters head to the polls on Tuesday.
And in the race to unseat Detroit's first Latina council member, Raquel Castaneda Lopez from District 6, what can you tell us about the money getting pumped into that race?
There's an organization called Detroit Community Impact Committee, which is a super PAC that formed on October 10th and almost immediately began sending out mailers against the incumbent councilwoman there, Castaneda Lopez. And these mailers have been very negative, criticizing her voting record and supporting her opponent, Tyrone Carter. Because it's a super PAC, we can see where some of the money is coming from. It's coming from a company called Central Transport, which is tied to the Maroon family. So we've been able to follow the money in that case and see that where it came from and who the organization is paying for it. It's funny, though, in that case, you know, I asked Tyrone Carter, who is the candidate running against the incumbent there, does he know anything about this super PAC? And he told me, I wouldn't even know what a super PAC was until someone told me about this. So, you know, these are municipal elections, and you have some of these large outside groups getting involved in them.
And what are you seeing in Detroit's mayoral race, where Mike Duggan is being challenged by Coleman Young II?
The mayoral race in Detroit is really a crucial one for people to watch if they're interested in the subject of money and politics. In this race, you have a very large super PAC called Turnaround Detroit, which has raised $800,000 in just a matter of months. That is, from all accounts, supporting Mayor Duggan through TV advertisements and potentially even mailers. And when you talk about the ability of a super PAC to raise $800,000, that money came from about 20 sources. One of the donations was $250,000. And it's another example of how campaign spending in our elections is moving from candidates who are limited in the amount of money they can take from individual donors to these independent super PACs that can take unlimited amounts of money from donors, but aren't supposed to be working closely with the candidates.
Craig, bottom line, what should voters do when they see these mailers, they hear commercials sponsored by some kind of group called StupidRegisteredVoter.com or whatever the group is? What should they do and what questions should be in their minds?
I tell people all the time, if you get a mailer, you see a TV ad, it is always important to also take into consideration who is communicating the message to you. That's a crucial part of understanding mailers and political communications that you receive. It's just as important as what the mailer says as who paid for it. You know, we've seen situations where it appeared, you know, potentially Democratic funding sources were sending out mailers to Republican, you know, likely voters criticizing Republican candidates for not being Republican enough. So these things can go in so many different directions that it's critically important that people at least look and see, you know, can I tell where the dollars behind this mailer came from? You know, we ask people if they get mysterious mailers to send them to us via email. You can go on our website, mcfn.org, and click on Contact Us to get our contact information. We try to track all of these things. It's extremely difficult to figure out who is sending out mailers.
Craig Mauger, Michigan Campaign Finance Network. As always, thanks, Craig.
Thank you.
Challenge. Opportunities.
The next idea.
Education. It's not a mechanical system, it's a human system. It's about people.
If you're a certain age, you probably remember sitting in science class watching educational films like this on a noisy projector, because 40 or 50 years ago, this was as interactive as it got.
By the way, you can grow both these crystals, nickel sulfate and sodium nitrate, by recipes given in the film notes in case you want to play around with the stuff yourself.
Well, fast forward to today, to a new program from the Michigan Science Center based in Detroit that brings interactive, hands-on science demonstrations to classrooms all over Michigan remotely. Today's guest on The Next Idea used to be a classroom teacher, but these days she's the distance learning coordinator at the Michigan Science Center. Jean Ann Sharara is also the main presenter for the new ECHO program, and apparently she can make a pretty mean fire tornado as well. Jean Ann, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thanks for having me.
What is ECHO?
So ECHO actually stands for Engaging in Collaborative Hands-on Learning. What we do is we run distance learning programs from the Michigan Science Center, so you can experience learning fun in a highly interactive way without leaving your classroom or having to come to the Science Center.
So what kind of program might you offer through ECHO?
We have a few different programs, K through 5 currently, and each program sort of has demonstrations that the kids could see, so things a teacher can't do in their classroom or maybe can't afford to do in the classroom, like liquid nitrogen, dry ice, fire tornadoes, as we've mentioned before, and also we'll ship out some hands-on experiences to the students so that they could do something within their own grasp.
So let's say that there's a youngster sitting in a classroom in the Upper Peninsula. They'll see you on a screen doing these things, but then you also have materials to support that so they can actually recreate some of that in their classroom.
Yeah. So we will send them supplies that are consumable supplies. The teacher could actually purchase themselves, but we just want to eliminate the teacher actually having to go out and do this kind of thing because we know they have such busy schedules. So we'll send them these sort of supplies, and I'll also do it in my studio, and the kids could engage with us hands-on.
How many classrooms have used an Echo presentation so far?
So far, we've done 3 classroom connections. We just launched in September, and we're actually looking to book a little bit more. We have a new program called Frostology that's available starting at the end of November into March. And this Frostology program is actually pretty fun, where we explore different wintry science experiments like dry ice, liquid nitrogen, insta-snow, and slime.
Oh, and yeah, that's going to, especially the little ones, that's going to catch them
Definitely.
Right away. And this really is aimed at helping science teachers who are in there in that classroom every day. As you say, there's a lot of pressure on these folks.
Definitely. Sometimes some of our programs are actually designed to teach really cool content and engage teachers and students in different career choices that they'd never thought of before. And others are just more fun and just a science enrichment for there's a day that you just want to take a break and maybe do something that's still educationally related. And some of these programs could help with that.
Having been a survivor of those educational films, like we heard at the top, where you thought it was a big deal if you saw the big old film projector get wheeled in and watching some guy in a short sleeve white shirt and a black tie doing his experiments. I've got to imagine it's a lot more more engaging for kids to watch you and then be able to do it themselves because you've provided those supplies.
It's different for kids because a lot of times they don't get to interact with videos that they watch on YouTube or things that teacher pulls up. So what's cool about this is you can actually talk to the person on the screen. And once they catch wind of that I'm actually talking back and answering their questions, they get super excited.
So you are totally interactive. You hear them, they hear you. It's as if you're right there.
Exactly. They have some really cool questions. I like to do a little Q&A at the end, maybe 10 minutes. But throughout, we also just try to keep it really interactive so it's not just a talking head. And again, it's similar to a YouTube video. We want to keep away from that, where they can actually interact at any point that they'd like.
How do you hope Echo will expand in the future?
Oh, I hope that we could go internationally. So maybe reaching to places like Australia, Africa, and anywhere all over the world.
Jean Ann Girara, who is the Distance Learning Coordinator at the Michigan Science Center. Thank you for being on The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
A century ago, the biggest man-made blast prior to the atomic bomb wiped out half of Halifax, Nova Scotia, killing and injuring thousands. Coming up next, John U. Bacon on his new book, The Great Halifax Explosion. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We're about to mark the 100th anniversary of one of the greatest maritime disasters ever, the Halifax explosion, when two ships collided in Halifax Harbor. The resulting explosion was the biggest man-made blast prior to the atomic bomb. Some 2,000 people killed and many thousands more were injured. Yet this cataclysmic event is largely forgotten, at least here on the U.S. side of our border with Canada. But John U. Bacon is changing that with his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. Welcome now, not wearing your Michigan Radio Sports commentator hat, but your New York Times bestselling author hat.
Well, thank you very much.
You know, we have talked about your books exploring football and, you know, Michigan sports programs and the mental health struggles of your friend, the late John Saunders of ESPN. Now for something completely different, the Great Halifax Explosion. What turned your attention to this?
Two things. The two sides of my family, the Bacons, were in New York throughout the whole process, the last 200 years. The other side, the Canadian side, went north to New Brunswick. My grandfather was 12 years old in 1917 when this happened. I used to spend my summers in New Brunswick talking to him. He kept on telling me about this, you know, 2-ton anchor that went 2 miles this way, another part that went 3 miles that way. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't think he was crazy, but I never heard of it anywhere else until 1999, when I'm researching my first book on the history of University of Michigan hockey. It turns out Michigan's first hockey coach happens to have been a first responder, if you will, to the Halifax explosion. And that's what inspired him to become a doctor, go to U of M, and start Michigan's hockey program.
So you started digging and digging.
I did, and I got lucky and lucky because it turns out his papers, his letters, Joseph Bars was a great letter writer, and his grandchildren, who are here in the state, and I know them, they've got his letters from World War I, where he served for a year and ended up getting hit with a shell and handicapped for a little while and overcame that. His letters from Halifax and his letters from the University of Michigan. And I just got really, really lucky.
All right. Talk about this explosion, December 6th, 1917, in Halifax Harbor. When you think about how big was it? Can you put that into context for us?
Yeah, this always stuns people that they had 6 million pounds of TNT and other high explosives on this ship. That's a bad idea. That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty on one ship. So you should not do that in the first place, but they were desperate. It's 1917. The Russians have left the war, so now the Eastern Front has been conceded to the Germans, and they're paranoid of the Germans rolling over the British, the French, and now the Americans who just joined the war. So you're overdoing this. Then, of course, you bump into another ship in Halifax Harbor. That's a bad idea. A fire starts. The crew takes off for the other shore, so no one is warned. And this ghost ship, now burning, slides perfectly into Pier 6 at the base of Halifax at 8:46 a.m. So people are walking to work. They're walking to school. The school children take a detour and go to watch this thing. Thousands are watching the ship burn. And at 9:04:35, it finally explodes. And in 1/15th of a second, less time than it takes to blink, half of Halifax is gone. 25,000 are homeless, about half the city. 9,000 are wounded. 2,000 are dead in a split second. It was 1/5 the power of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. And we know that because Oppenheimer, who's the master behind the atomic bomb, he studied this at a conference at Cal Berkeley in 1942. It's the only other comparison they had for the A-bomb. So that's how serious this was. That's the horrible news. And the great news happens afterwards.
Indeed. Getting back to where we were historically, as you say, World War I had been going on for more than 3 years. The U.S. had entered the fight that spring of 1917. How key was Halifax to the war effort?
Halifax was the conduit for almost everything from North America going to the Great War. That includes Americans and Canadian soldiers, almost all materials, food, supplies, munitions, relief supplies, you name it. Almost any British soldier not already in Britain was going to go through Halifax, as well as the Americans. So that was a crucial, arguably the most crucial port during World War I.
And history happens when you get two entities winding up in the same place at the same time, that one in a million thing. In this case, two ships, the SS Mont Blanc and the SS Emo. Now, tell us about them and why they were in Halifax Harbor that fateful morning.
Mont Blanc was going to Bordeaux, France, to turn that 6 million pounds of explosives into shells to bomb Germans.
And basically, as you say, loaded beyond the gills with incredible explosives to the point where the captain said, nobody can light a cigarette.
No one can even hold a match in your pocket. That's how terrified they were. They lined the hull with plywood to make sure there's no metal-on-metal contact, because they knew that one spark could send them up. They secured the holds with copper nails because copper is one of the few metals that does not spark when struck. They feared that one spark, one rub, could send them all up. They lined their shoes, their boots, with canvas covers to make sure they didn't spark. So these guys in the ship knew that this was a floating time bomb, basically.
So they were pulling into Halifax Harbor?
They were pulling into Halifax Harbor, and they think after 4 days by themselves, no convoy, from New York, Brooklyn, New York, to Halifax, they think, okay, finally we're safe. Relax. And they went through not one, but two metal gates underwater, which kept the U-boats, the German submarines, out of the harbor. So you're finally in. You're dying to get in here. It's 8:45 in the morning. The Emo, the Norwegian relief ship, was already a day late because of the same fences. The fences kept them from getting out the night before. So they're in a rush to go out. That captain is a hothead, which we make clear in this thing. So he's a problem, and he does not have any idea what Mont Blanc has on it.
Why is that? You'd think there would be warning flags.
One warning flag means the German U-boats just outside Halifax Harbor have you as a sitting duck. So about five guys in the whole harbor had any idea what was on the ship.
Okay. So
there's your problem.
There's your problem. Because it really is a Murphy's Law.
One thing after the other. And safeguards, some of them stupidly, the protocols were removed because, you know, they're in a haste. It's World War I. Guys are dying overseas, left and right. So the British Crown did not care that much what's happening in Halifax. They're worried about their guys getting mowed over in the trenches of Europe.
Isn't this a big harbor? How did these two wind up bumping up?
It's a big harbor, except for one part called the Narrows, which are, in fact, narrow. It's all of a sudden only 1,000 feet across for about a mile, 18-mile-long harbor. It's the second biggest natural harbor to Sydney, Australia. It's a great harbor. But now you've got two ships trying to get out, get past each other in this 1,000-foot-wide narrows, and the one ship, the Emo, keeps on ignoring the rules and going to the left and to the left and to the left of each successive ship. This is the same as driving a car on a two-lane road. You want to pass on the left, you better know what you're doing because there'll be a car coming by on the right. That car, in this case, was Mont Blanc.
Oh, boy. So they bump.
They bump. It's a game of chicken, and finally at the last second, Mont Blanc says this guy's crazy and he's not going to get on the correct side. So they try to peel off the last second, as we would on the highways, and try to peel off left. So does the Emo at the last second. So they bump, and it's not a big bump, but it's a big enough bump to knock over the airplane fuel on top. They had unwittingly constructed the perfect bomb with the fuse on top and the heavy explosives down below.
So it starts to burn. And the crew of the Mont Blanc, as you say, they knew what was going on. They got off that ship and paddled to safety, didn't they?
They had two rowboats, 20 people each, and they went the other direction to Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, across the Narrows.
And so here's this ghost ship.
This ghost ship now, which no one knows what's on it.
And the whole town's like, there's a ship burning. Let's go see.
And the war seems so far away, they don't imagine what's on it. And the timing is cruel, like I said, because everyone's going to work and to school. The stoves from breakfast are still burning in every home in Halifax, which is going to matter.
And the kind of explosion, I mean, you take us to that moment. Give us a for instance. You have so many victims of this explosion. What story really hit you hard?
As far as the power of it, my grandfather's story on the 2,000-pound anchor being flown 2 miles, that got my attention. Windows were blown out 50 miles away. And again, the whole town is just flattened. If you were standing within a quarter mile of it, you were flown a quarter mile up the hill, and you had no idea what just happened to you. But all of a sudden, you're at a new park, Needham Park, on the top of the hill of Halifax. So you're watching it 1 second. Next second, you've got black grime all over you. You're wet from the tidal wave that happens afterwards, a 35-foot tidal wave, which drowned those who survived, the first thing. And no one can believe what's happening. And the look of bewilderment was repeated often by people. No one was screaming or yelling. They're walking around like zombies. Like, what has just happened?
And people vanished, didn't they? Some of them, never to be found, no
trace.
There
are about 600 people we have no idea what happened to.
What kind of injuries, John, were most common?
Sad to say, facial wounds, because the town, it's like a miniature San Francisco. They got these beautiful homes, two-story homes, with bay windows, because the bay is beautiful, so they've all faced the bay. Everyone went to the bay windows and their workshops and so on to watch the Mont Blanc burn. Back then, there's no safety glass. This is the thin-paned stuff. So when they're watching, the facial wounds occur. About 300 or 400 were blinded during this process. And my great aunt, Aunt Ruth, lived in Halifax for a while. And you were taught when you grew up in Halifax in the 20s and 30s, if you see somebody with one of these blue-tinged facial scars, that's from the TNT itself, you are told to not stare because that's the explosion. So this went on for decades.
There was, amidst all of this disaster, you bring us some very special moments of human kindness, including a barbershop story.
And what's great about this is, obviously, a disaster you're never going to forget, but they remember the human kindness as much as anything else. And one beautiful little example among many in this book, Noble and Gordon Driscoll, 10 and 12 at the time, they go about an hour away for a haircut, because that's what we have to go for a haircut. That's where they're recovering. Mom gives them $1 to go in for a haircut. This is a week after the disaster. Okay. They still have glass shards, little bits of glass and wood in the back of their heads. So the barbers are cutting their hair and trying to get the oil out of their hair, which is very stubborn. And when the kid winces, when Noble winces, the barber says, "Ah, you must be from Halifax." He knows immediately. He goes over to the other barber and they whisper to each other, unbeknownst to the two kids. They go back and tell all the other customers, "We're not open today, got to go away." They give the kids two shampoos to make sure they get the oil out. They pull out all the little glass shards and wooden chips. And afterwards, Noble's getting very nervous because all he has is a dollar, and that will not pay for two shampoos and all the extra attention. He gives the barber a dollar, feeling embarrassed and a bit sheepish. And the barber waves it off and smiles. And with the other barber, they go across the street to a clothing store and buy the kids a new wardrobe because all their clothes are gone, except for what they're wearing. So, and 80 years later, what we remember is the barber. 100 years later now, that barber whose name I don't know, but that act of kindness lives on forever. And I think that's really, really cool.
I'm speaking with John Eubacon about his latest book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. And let's talk about that heroism, just like we saw after 9/11 when people and nations really came together, put aside differences to stand as one against a tragedy. There really was a coming together after the Halifax explosion, wasn't there?
No question. And it's true heroism. It really is. And it's from everybody. It's common people doing uncommon things. Just your neighbor all of a sudden going down into a basement to save a neighbor's baby. It is soldiers going into burning homes to get cats out, for crying out loud. It's again and again and again. The extraordinary heroism came from ordinary people. And we saw a lot of this during 9/11. This is on actually a grander scale, because those are two towers that the firemen go up and that's about it. This is all over town. This goes on for about a day and a half, this endless burning. So a 14-year-old girl is one of our heroes. Joseph Barge, we'll get to, is one of our heroes as well. And it's really inspiring. So those of you who are tired of disasters, it's about a quarter of it is set up. Middle third or so is the explosion. And then the last, whatever that leaves, my math
yes.
is off. almost a third or so, more than a third, is how the city and the people responded, including the Americans.
Yes, because there were testy relations, as you point out. We get a good history lesson into the formation of Canada, and things were a little testy, but particularly the city of Boston stepped up.
Really quite amazing. And look, I grew up with more Canadian history than most, given my mom being a Canadian native. I had no idea that we were not allies at all in 1917. In 1776, when the start of the war, that side of my family, including 60,000 other American colonists, went to New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. The American side of me calls them the scaredy cats.
Yeah.
The Canadian side is the United Empire Loyalists.
That's right.
So they basically founded New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, essentially. So they had no great feelings towards the U.S. In 1812, it's the Canadians versus the Americans, essentially, as well as the British, of course. The guy tried to burn down the presidential mansion, and he failed. He tried to burn it down, but it's made of white stucco,
yeah.
So you can't get very far with it. But it blackened it, and that forced them to whitewash it, which is why it's called the White House. That guy is buried with honor in the center of Halifax. So, and then you got Joseph Barge, the world's greatest privateer at the time in Canada. He sunk, captured, or burned more than 60 American ships, the most wanted man in America. And he was finally caught in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where they walked him up and down Main Street and fed him hardtack for 2 months.
A perp walk.
A perp walk, yeah. The world's first perp walk, probably, I suppose. So we were not allies, even in the Civil War. Half of Halifax supported the Confederates, and with great danger they did so, because they wanted the cotton. In 1911, I can't believe this either, the Speaker of the House of the United States, the Paul Ryan of his day, got on the floor of U.S. Congress to vociferously advocate for the annexation of Canada, and he received cheers and a glowing report from the Washington Post. 1911, American leaders were talking about annexing Canada. So we are not allies.
But Boston stepped up to a point where it's even recognized today.
It is recognized today in no small terms. Boston, they're still shipping towns. And even though they're at war for basically 100 years, when it happened, the Massachusetts governor, Samuel McCall, without even being asked, they send 2 trains, 2 ships, 100 doctors, 300 nurses, all the supplies you could ever imagine to run a couple hospitals for a few weeks at about $1 million of supplies, which is $20 million today, without being asked. And you talk to any of the survivors in the 70s or 80s, late in their life, the first thing they always mentioned was the help from Boston. And it turned, by the way, U.S. and Canada into allies. That's where it starts. The Halifax is so appreciative. To this day, they spend $180,000 to find their best spruce tree in the entire province, 50 feet high or so. Usually a private citizen. They've got a cutting ceremony. They load it on a truck. They send it 600 miles down to Boston. They raise it in Boston Common for the holidays. They light it in a big ceremony. It costs them $180,000, and no Bostonians or very few have any idea why they're being thanked. But as a Haligonian, as they're called, said, they said, why should we stop thanking them? Which to me is such a great spirit and so counter to what we see internationally right now.
Indeed.
This is how people are supposed to get along.
And other things too. Medicine? There were medical advances made because of what was encountered in the aftermath?
Ophthalmology, eye surgery was greatly advanced because you had all these doctors in town who spread best practices. And as I said, there are hundreds of blinded people from Halifax. Pediatric surgery. A guy named Dr. Ladd from Boston came up and he realized during the burn victims, the kid burn victims in Halifax, that you have to approach this differently than you do adult burn victims for various reasons. He goes back to Boston, has a 2-bed clinic, and from that he gets a whole wing. Talk to any pediatric surgeon, and they'll tell you the father of pediatric surgery is Dr. Ladd, and he learned it in Halifax.
And then, astoundingly, the Great Halifax Explosion, as you say, has a direct connection to men's hockey at the University of Michigan.
This is my favorite of the stories, as you might imagine.
I can guess.
But,
yeah, all things do come down to University of Michigan.
Of course
athletics.
They do. Why shouldn't they? But that privateer I mentioned, yes, who sunk 60 and burned and captured 60 American ships, his great-grandson also grew up not liking Americans too much. He fought in World War I. He's all gung-ho about it. He got hit with a shell, came back to learn how to walk again in Halifax when the boat blew up. And he knows first aid. So by the end of the weekend, he is basically performing surgeries he has no business performing, but it's all hands on deck, 9,000 wounded.
Because he'd been on the battlefield in World
exactly.
War
I. Exactly, and you got 9,000 wounded, so what can you do?
Yeah.
That's when he realizes, I don't want to be a businessman in Montreal, which he was, making good money. I don't want to be a soldier. I don't want to be a pastor like my father. I want to be a doctor. I want to heal people, not kill them. And his uncle gives them $100 and says, go to the University of Michigan. And I'm not quite sure why. His cousin was there in surgery, so perhaps that was it. He comes to Ann Arbor. He marries a woman from Battle Creek, an American. He becomes an American citizen because the Bostonians so impressed him. He said, I've changed my view forever about Americans based on Boston. Becomes a citizen, goes down to Fielding Yost's office, the athletic director at the time, and says, you need a hockey program. He said, only if you're the first coach. So while a med school student, while married, he starts the hockey program. It has now won 9 national titles, which is a national record. It starts with the Halifax Explosion.
This is an extraordinary book, John Eubakin's book, The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. And it officially comes out tomorrow, November 7th, and he'll be speaking about the book at Rackham Auditorium on the University of Michigan campus tomorrow night, Tuesday the 7th at 7 p.m., presented by Literati Bookstore. And I will have the pleasure of introducing my friend and New York Times bestselling author. So it ought to be a good night. There's no charge for tickets, and you can register by going to Literati's Facebook page. You put a lot of work, a lot of time into telling this story, and I can tell it has really grabbed you and moved you.
It has, and even writing it, I got choked up a few times. People have already read it in the early going, you included, have gotten choked up a few times. It's a story about disaster, but how people respond to the disaster, and these people ended up living very good lives. That's incredible. They lost, you know, 5 siblings, and it's horrible, obviously, and they find ways to pick themselves up, and people who have interviewed them say they have such great perspective. They are so patient. This is before they passed away, obviously, in the 70s and 80s, and they're so good-hearted. And that's the lesson of this whole thing, is that no matter what happens to you in this world, somehow they have found a way to live good, productive, contributing lives.
A lesson for the ages. John Eubakin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, we talk with longtime Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero about his legacy. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of comfort food, of soul food, do you think vegan?
Definitely not. That's not my idea of vegan, no.
Get some kind of soy barbecue.
Well, barbecue, vegan. That's all meat.
Well, when I think of soul food, I think of culture. Honestly, that's the first thing that comes to my mind. It's like, you know, African-American culture.
Well, first of all, when I think of soul food, I think of deliciousness, amazing cheeses and sauces and seasonings. And when I think of vegan food, I want to know how you make macaroni and cheese without cheese. I don't know what it's going to be like, but I would try it for sure.
Yeah, I would be open to trying it, but I'm not going to go in with high expectations.
And that was Amanda and Rob Moore and Ariel and Quill Verdun standing outside Slow's Barbecue, a Corktown, Detroit restaurant well known for its menu of slowly cooked barbecue meats. About 5 miles away, however, Detroiters Kirsten Ussery Boyd and Erica Boyd are trying to change Soul Food's carnivorous reputation. The pair created the restaurant Detroit Vegan Soul 3 years ago. Stateside's Claire Bryan paid a visit to the restaurant to see how things are going.
Detroit Vegan Soul really started with our own personal journeys and wanting to break the cycle of disease in our families. So in my family, it's diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. In her family, it's cancer. And so we were on our own personal journey to improve our health, and we experimented with being vegetarian on and off, you know, each of us throughout the years, even before we met one another. But then Erica's father passed away of prostate cancer, and that was the pivotal point for us because he didn't smoke or drink, but he had a terrible, you know, standard American diet. Before becoming vegan, the doctor told me that if I didn't make a change in my diet that I was going to have diabetes. And so after becoming vegan, you know, my health was, it just completely turned around. We both lost weight. We both felt a lot better. But at the time, there weren't really a lot of vegan options, food options here in Detroit. There weren't a lot of healthy options, period.
All right, got the coffee, looking good. Have you made some food decisions for brunch? Yeah. What sounds good to you?
This is my first time. I thought it was an absolutely fantastic idea. And I was interested in, you know, how tasty soul food would be in a vegan format.
You know, I knew it would be amazing because I think the majority of ethnic foods and have started with vegetable dishes, so I knew there'd be a lot of collard greens. I knew that they'd make an excellent, you know, smothered dishes, the yams, the mac and cheese. So that's what I was really looking forward to, is those soul dishes, those sides.
Well, I was vegetarian, partly vegan, like 13 years ago for a while, and then I stopped. But I, the documentary What the Health, I started being vegetarian about 3 months ago, and then I stumbled upon What the Health like a month and a half ago. And so I've really been trying to pick it up from there.
Can I do the collard greens and the mashed potatoes? Thank you.
Would you like gravy on the mashed potatoes?
Yes.
The idea is that we want to make vegan food approachable to people. So we want to do it in a way that's not intimidating. We want to show people that vegan food is flavorful, that, because when it comes down to it, that's really what it's about, is flavor and texture for people. So if we can give people a positive experience with vegan food where it actually is not so foreign from what they're used to, you know, it's still filling, it makes them think that they're eating something that they just would normally eat, then we think that the light bulb will go off for people and they'll say, and this literally happens in the restaurant, people will say, well, I can do this. I could do this a couple days a week, or, you know, and so that we fulfilled our mission, because we just want people to incorporate more plant-based food into their lives. It would be great if everyone became vegan, but just by incorporating more plant-based foods, we can cut down on some of the diet-related diseases that our community is experiencing.
Come next January, Lansing will have itself a new mayor for the first time in a dozen years. That's because Mayor Virge Bernero chose not to run for re-election. Last week, Stateside was in Greater Lansing for our Stateside live show, and it seemed like a perfect chance to sit down with the mayor and do an exit interview. In front of a live audience at Michigan State University, I asked Bernero about those early days as mayor back in 2006. What were things like in Lansing and what he inherited?
It was pretty slow. There was, some would say, a malaise, but I don't want to sound too much like Jimmy Carter. One of my heroes, though. But when you look at the growth that we got, even then, I mean, we look back on it. Luckily, we had a few great local entrepreneurs who were willing to invest, but we really used the tools. And I know some of these have become political fodder, cannon fodder a little bit, these economic incentives. But, you know, the rule of cities in Michigan, I mean, as a rule, cities generally are in decline. Okay, obviously I'm excluding Ann Arbor and East Lansing, you know, maybe Grand Rapids, but cities generally are the hole in the donut and not the hub of the wheel, and that's a real shame, and we do not realize the calamity that it is. We do not deal with it like it's a crisis. We do not deal with it like it's a calamity. In fact, we keep piling on. We pile on because most of our state reps are from townships. We are stuck with a township form of government that started with Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which we are still organized around. And I'm not here to just beat up on townships, not just solely to beat up on townships. I'm here for other reasons too. But no, the point is, this is an antiquated model where we've got city versus suburb, and we have not found a way yet in Michigan to really make a metro region win. And the winning formula around the country is metro regions, metro areas, Lansing Metro, Ann Arbor Metro. Now, you know, you'll have some exceptions. Ann Arbor is one, Grand Rapids is one. You'll have some exceptions where cities are growing. But my hometown of Pontiac, look at Detroit. It's coming back now after Herculean efforts by billionaires and millionaires. But left to its own devices, Detroit was failing.
Let me just take you right now where you are, nearly 12 years later. You're not running for another term, so we're in the final weeks of your time as mayor. 10 years from now, when you're sitting there thinking about your time and looking back at your time as mayor of Lansing, what are you going to be remembering fondly with pride?
Well, I mean, I remember it. I'll remember it today and always as the best job I ever had.
Why?
It is phenomenal. It's an opportunity to make a difference like never before. It is a job I never wanted, by the way, until sort of at the last minute, once I realized how much the Senate stunk. But no. Until I realized how much I was needed. No. But no. The thing is, I always wanted to make a difference. I was student body president and all that. I always knew I wanted to be in politics. It was all I ever wanted to do. I have loved it. And I never really did seek mayor, because when I read about mayor, it seemed like mayors were always either indicted or died in office or were thrown out of office. And none of them sounded that great to me. So, Congress seemed like a much better way to go, and then maybe president. And so mayor just seemed like you'd be stuck with like potholes and barking dogs and funeral processions. These things matter, though. It's the lifeblood of a city, economic development, jobs. You're at the human level. You're at the ground floor of where people are. There's just nothing like it, because you're really right there with the people, and you're able to see the difference. My frustration with the Senate, I didn't mean to malign the senators, but my frustration with the legislature is just that it's so slow going, and you don't, you're a little isolated. You're in that chamber, when you're mayor, people are in your face, and when you're shopping, wherever you are, people are right there, and they can come to your office, and they can come to a council meeting. You're right where the people are, and you can make a difference today. And of course, it's immediate, and it's demanding, and it's like drinking out of a fire hose.
What are you going to miss?
Maybe I'll miss my cell phone ringing in the middle of the night. I'll miss, I guess, knowing. I'll miss a sense of control. A sense that I'm that relevant. I was in the Senate. I was in the House. I was a county commissioner. I was one of 38 state senators, but there was nothing like being mayor, both good and bad. If you're on vacation, you're never far from your cell phone. If something happens in your city when you're mayor, you come back. When you're in the legislature, issues come and issues go. It's like, oh, well, now this issue, now that issue. And then when it goes off the desk, it goes off the desk. But when you're mayor, issues like crime, whether it's lighting a park, parks, roads, the issues never go away. They never change and they never go away.
So if I ask you, what won't you miss? Your friends on the city council?
Yes, the council. did I misspeak? The council. That's a joke, my friends. That's a joke. Thank you for laughing. And mayors everywhere know what I mean. This is international. International.
All you mayors get together.
The three toughest things about the job of mayor is the council, labor, and the media. And those three things have not gotten easier in 12 years. And in part, the media, let me just critique your industry for a minute. The media, because now it's social media too, and too many times they're driving it. And I never had any problem with the media. I don't agree with Trump that the media, they're all, I don't agree with that approach that they're all, I would never malign the media. You play a vital role and you represent the public. And I've always respected the media and taken their calls and questions and interviews. And my experience with journalists, and I'm not just saying this for you, Cynthia, but my experience with journalists is almost universally positive, that they're really wonderful, as opposed to what the president says. They're wonderful people who actually care deeply about the truth. It bothers me the way he speaks about journalists, because my personal experience being in politics for 30 years is that the journalists, most all of them, care deeply about the truth. And especially what amazes me is that the new young journalists still coming out that come from the TV stations when they're just in training, they care deeply about the truth. They're trying to get to the truth. And how can I hold that against them? I don't. Of course, I want them to buy my version of the truth. But,
it's the perennial dance.
But it has been a phenomenal run. I hope Lansing is better off after my 12 years. I think it is.
During your tenure as mayor, there's been a lot of private investment. Accident Fund Insurance took over the old Ottawa Power Station as its headquarters. Jackson National came to Lansing. GM moved Camaro production from Canada to Lansing. How did you sell the Lansing area that got hit pretty hard during the recession to these outside investors? What was your sales pitch?
Well, mostly workforce. It really is leveraging your advantage. It's leveraging your assets. It's really not that much rocket science. And economic development is, it's both economic gardening and economic hunting, right? So a lot of times we think about economic development just as economic hunting, go out and find some big company. But actually, I think it's about an 80-20 proposition. I think in today's day and age, it's 80-20, that 80% of economic development is economic gardening. What does that mean? It means nurturing the businesses that you have. And when I say nurturing business, also nurturing the students, the education system, making sure that you're teaching, that you're promoting entrepreneurialism, that you're helping kids. Paying attention to workforce, supply chain, making sure that you have the skilled trades workers that are needed. We formed a new economic development entity while I was here, LEAP, the Lansing Economic Area Partnership. And so we stopped competing against each other, city to city, township to township. Instead of trying to steal businesses from each other, we're trying to have a global window on the world so we can bring businesses in from all around the world.
You have accomplished an awful lot, and at the same time, you've taken heat over the years. You've been called the angriest mayor for a reason with your direct and some may say abrasive style. You took a lot of heat following the Christmas 2013 ice storm, standing behind board of Water and Light President Peter Lark for some felt maybe too long, some of the mystery surrounding former city attorney Janine McIntyre's abrupt departure and settlement. Any regrets?
I don't have time for regrets. I learned a lot in this job. Again, I think we did a lot of good. You know, out of the ice storm came incredible changes at the board, improvements at the board. You know, we have the largest public utility in the state with the Lansing Board of Water and Light. They're outstanding. I have a role to play in that, and I have stepped up and done that. And I think it's a much stronger utility than it is today. As far as employment decisions, you know, people come and people go. I'm a very loyal person. Very few of my staff has turned over. I stand behind my people. And just like in the private sector, there are times, you know, when people go, and it's not always advertised. We're in a litigious society, and so there are times when people go and you don't shout from the highest mountain. I would like to be that complete transparent about everything. I would love to be. But the fact is, you know, occasionally there are things that for legal reasons aren't. And so I think if people look at everything that I've done, I hope they will, that it was a net plus.
When your successor steps into office, for that first day next January, what's this new mayor going to be inheriting from you? What's the health of the city, do you think?
We're in pretty good shape in the basics, the fundamentals. But let's face it, we're number one for now that Flint and Detroit are off that list for a variety of reasons. We're now number one for unfunded health care, OPEB, what they call OPEB, unfunded health care for retirees and pension. And it adds up to, I think, somewhere around $500 million. I appointed a financial health team to really dig into that. You know, they're going to inherit that, and they're going to inherit a report that says this is what you should do. Had I stayed, I would have dug into that right away in my first year of my fourth term. I would urge the new mayor to dig into it in the first year of their new term. It is not going away. It is not getting smaller. It is something that will have to be contended with. A lot of cities and counties around the state have this. I think the state needs to work in a tandem with cities to address this. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot of cities going bankrupt. That's the biggest challenge. In terms of data, you know, that's the kind of thing that people don't see. It's like a hidden dark cloud that's coming our way. But I think the livability of the city, the walkability, the livability, the attractiveness of the city, I think you're seeing Michigan Avenue become our miracle mile. I think the figurative distance between Michigan State University and the Capitol is shortening. I think we still need some easier public transportation. I think if we could get a rail line between Lansing and East Lansing, it would be phenomenal. But generally, you know, all the indicators are in the right direction. Crime is down, GDP is up, unemployment is down, population is up. So a lot of things are heading in the right direction. But cities do not just, you know, it's like pushing a boulder uphill. Because a city can slide back very easily. In Michigan, the laws work against us. Whether you're talking about economic development laws, education, land use, you name it, transportation policy, they work against the cities. Believe me, it's not right, but it's the way it is. I fought this for 12 years. We are a state that really favors townships, and it's a terrible thing. It makes no sense because we rise and fall together. We really should look at metro regions and how we can win together, but we have not. We are very parochial. We are very siloed. It doesn't work. If our cities are not winning, the state is not winning. And if you want to know why the state overall, if you get the sense that other states are moving ahead beyond Michigan, you're right. If you think that other states will continue to beat Michigan, you're right. Because until you get the cities right, you're not going to grow the state. You're not going to win your young people. And if you're not winning your young people, and I've had older folks, my age and older, say to me, all you care about is the young people. All you talk about is millennials. Well, you know what? It's not just because I have two beautiful daughters, but, you know, they are the future. If we're not looking for the future, who do you think's going to buy your house? You know, when finally, if you move out of your house or if you, you know, you decide or you have to go, who's going to come and buy your house? We have to have the young people. And generally speaking, cities around the state, too many of them are in decline. And we do not study it. We do not focus on it. You can't grow the state with suburbs alone because young people don't move to suburbs. Young people move to cities. They want thriving urban centers. We need metro regions that work.
Now, I heard you say you're carrying the baton, so you're not thinking about what comes next? after this
That's
chapter.
True. That's true.
Except on January 2nd, you're going to turn that cell phone off?
I will keep my number, so feel free to call. But who knows? But I'm excited. I am now excited. You know, I went through all the phases of loss because it is something phenomenal. You know, and I remember I talked to Jerry Abramson, who was the mayor of Louisville. He's like the dean of mayors. Mm-hmm. We all have great respect for Abramson because of what he accomplished in Louisville with the One Louisville Initiative. They have a metro government, a thriving metro government, and Louisville, of course, is growing off the charts. And he was in the West Wing of the White House. He worked for President Obama on domestic policy. And I said, look at you, Jerry Abramson. My God, here you are in the West Wing of the White House. And I was lucky enough to be there. I was pinching myself. I said, my God, you know, you were mayor of Louisville. Now here you are in the West Wing advising the president on urban affairs. I said, you've really arrived. He said, Virg, he said, I arrived. He said, when I was mayor of Louisville, he said, there will never be a better job. He said, don't tell my boss, but there will never be a better job than mayor. He said, enjoy it while you've got it. And he was absolutely right.
A view from the mayor's office. Mayor Virg Bonero, thank you so very much for being with
Thanks
us on Stateside.
Me,
it was great to have
great
you with
to
us.
Talk to you.
And that's our show for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.